All right then, brethren, we spoke a couple of weeks or so back about whether a person could be righteous in God's sight, or whether, in fact, all of us suffer from, you know, filthy rags syndrome. All our righteous deeds are as our filthy rags in God's sight. And hopefully we saw that that was not the case. God himself called, you know, Noah righteous. Jesus referred to righteous Abel. Luke referred to righteous Zacharias and Elizabeth. Peter referred to righteous Lot, and on it went. So the answer is we can be righteous in God's sight, and there have been many righteous men and women. But of course, these men and women were not perfect. They didn't go around with their hands folded and sort of a halos balanced over their heads, simpering along with a pious look. These men and women were righteous, but they all had flaws. They had human weaknesses. But perhaps one key characteristic which they had, which we looked at last week in more detail, was that these men and women appeared to be pretty much people who were faithful. They had the characteristic of faithfulness, you know, or loyalty to God. So even though they all made mistakes at times, some small mistakes, some really quite serious, they were all, by and large, loyal to God, faithful to him, even if times were occasionally very difficult. I think last week we likened it to, say, you know, marriage vows. You know, many churches, many marriage vows tend to include words along the lines of each takes the other for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. In other words, marriage vows, vows of faithfulness, vows of loyalty, are to stand whether times are good or times are not so good. When the wind's behind you, when the wind's in your face, you should be, we should be faithful, loyal people. And of course, all of us will face various trials and temptations at various times of our lives. Temptations, trials, and tests are common to man. But our task, in a sense, is to remain loyal and faithful throughout. You know, last week we touched very briefly on Ruth. Now, she was a marvelous example of loyalty and faithfulness. She said to Naomi, "I'm not leaving you. I'm sticking with you. Where you go, I will go." And she said, "Even when you're dead, when I'm dead, I'll be buried right next to you." So, you know, neither life nor hardship nor even death will separate us. So she was a great example of faithfulness. And of course, you know, her name is mentioned there in the genealogy of the Lord Jesus Christ, Book of Matthew. We also saw some weeks back the example of Solomon. He was not faithful. Enough said. So today I'd like to review the life of another interesting character, which is Joseph, to see his example. I'm talking of Joseph in the days of Pharaoh and Egypt and so on, not Mary's husband. Because Joseph is, I think you'll see, a pretty good example of one who was faithful and remained faithful in some really pretty difficult times. And yet they often say, you know, experience can be a good teacher, and you and I have got plenty of experiences. But, of course, experience can often be a very hard teacher. Probably best if we tend to learn from other people's mistakes, good ideas, and learn from them. And, of course, the Bible does illustrate to us men and women who did good or not so good. So looking at the story of Joseph, and we'll be in the book of Genesis much of the time, you know, Joseph was one of 12 brothers, the 12 sons of Jacob or Israel. Difficult family, as we'll see. There were four mothers involved, so you get 12 boys, but they don't all have the same mother. There was Leah and Rachel and Bilhah and Zilpah. So four different mothers, 12 boys, and it's pretty evident they were a fairly carnal group of individuals. Really verging on a dysfunctional family, you could say. And of course, their father, Jacob, wasn't exactly the very best of examples, was he? Because his history, including quite a bit of cheating and deception. So the family has its problems. But let's pick up the story of Joseph, starting in Genesis chapter 37. And you better keep a place marker of some sort round about Genesis 37, 38, because we'd be popping backwards and forwards there. But let's begin this part in Genesis 37, read verses 1 through 4. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the genealogy of Jacob. And then we move on now to the story of Joseph. Joseph, being 17 years old, just a teenager, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad Joseph was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. So who knows what they're up to, these other older brothers of his, but Joseph came back and was telling stories. I imagine they're probably accurate stories, but nonetheless, telling tales on your brothers, right? Not necessarily a good idea. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age and also, of course, the son of his favorite wife, Rachel. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So you can see some problems here already. You know, it's not really wise of Jacob to show such favoritism to one boy out of 12. You know, maybe he'd have a favorite, but he ought to manage that. Not make too much of a fuss of young Joseph, who, by the looks of it, was a pampered young boy. Special tunic, coat of many colors, sets him apart, dad's favorite. And, of course, the rest of the boys don't like that. Says here they hated him. Right, brothers? And here's, you know, quite a number who hate their younger brother. And, of course, you know, that's a good lesson for parents today. If you've got more than one child's not a problem.
Well,
you know, they're going to be the favorite anyway, but if you get two or more, you know, certainly in my family, when I was growing up, I was the favored son, and my two younger sisters, you know, could see that, and I think at times it may have caused a little bit of a problem. So you got to be careful, you know. If you get more than one child, you don't want to single one out unnecessarily. It will cause, potentially, problems. Moving on, verses 5 through 11. Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. There clearly are levels of hatred, and Joseph is rising rapidly up them. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. Hey guys, I've had a dream that you'd never guess was going to happen." Verse 7, "There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Hey guys, what about that then? And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Right? Not a good idea to be, you know, boasting in this way. And he hasn't finished. Verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. I must be special, guys. I've had another dream. You won't believe this one, boys. This time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him as well as hated him. but his father kept the matter in mind. Now, we know later that these dreams actually sort of came true. So these dreams, you know, quite clearly came from God. They were God-given dreams, and I'm sure at times in future years, these dreams might well, you know, motivate Joseph, give him hope when times were looking pretty dark, as they did from time to time. But there's one thing pretty plain from this early story of Joseph, which is that he completely lacked tact. He wasn't really very sensitive, was he? But he was the pampered son with a multicolored robe. He was special, and he didn't mind telling his older brothers, "Hey guys, you're going to bow down to me one time according to my special dreams." Not tactful, not wise, and it created jealousy, envy, and a great deal of hatred. And really all of us, all the time, need to learn the value of tact and controlling our tongues. Just because something is right or true doesn't necessarily mean it's wise to blab it. There's a time and a place, perhaps. So hold your place there. But have a look at Proverbs 13 and 3. So keep your place there. We're coming back. But Proverbs 13 and verse 3. A lesson here that perhaps Joseph learned latterly. But as a 17-year-old, he certainly didn't know it. "He who guards his mouth preserves his life. But he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction." And it was good advice to Joseph, to you, and to me, to guard our mouths. It can preserve our lives. But if you open wide your mouth, let it all rip out. Give those people a piece of your mind. Potentially, destruction, you know, will follow. And it says elsewhere in Ecclesiastes, there's a time to keep silence and a time to speak. And it starts with a time to keep silence. That's probably the more important, a time to keep silence. And then, of course, there is a time to speak. And a wise person like you and me should know which is the right time. Silence or speaking? You know, there's a proverb that says, diplomacy, the art of diplomacy is thinking twice before saying nothing. You know, if you keep your mouth shut, it can be safer a lot of the time. But anyway, young Joseph didn't realize that, so he's creating a lot of tension, jealousy, and hatred in the family. Let's move on back to Genesis 37. Let's read verses 12 through 36. So the brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, I guess a bit later, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them." So he said to him, "Well, here I am." Then he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent Joseph out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field, this young 17-year-old. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" He said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "Oh, they've departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, and of course you probably recognize the garment, if nothing else, but probably you recognize him as well. When they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him. Really? To kill him. And that's fratricide, isn't it? If you kill your brother. But, you know, these are the sons of Israel. And they're talking about killing their young brother. So, carnal bunch, really. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming." These dreams have got under their skin, haven't they? "Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, 'Oh, some wild beast has devoured him.' We'll see what becomes of his dreams then, when he's dead." But Reuben, who's the elder, of course, the firstborn, heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, like a sort of a water cistern, but it was empty. Do not lay a hand on him, in order that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father, which, in a sense, Reuben is not really being a strong leader here, is he? He's the firstborn, but if you get real courage, real authority, somebody say, guys, what are you on about? This is our brother. Shut up, you lot. But he doesn't. It's sort of a half-hearted, well, let's just throw him in here, and then I'll come back quietly when nobody's looking and sort of, rescue him. So not entirely bad, but certainly a very weak example of leadership. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty, there was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. So even though you've thrown your brother into a pit with the intention of pretty much leaving him there, and elsewhere it tells us that Joseph, was shouting and pleading to be rescued. He was only 17 after all. And they sat down to eat a meal, time for some chicken nuggets and some French fries, a bottle of Coke. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on the way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit? Of course, some people say, that's interesting. The first words ever of a Jew, Judah, are what profit? Because Jews have always been, accused, rightly or wrongly, of being after, usury, interest, Rothschilds, running banks, Merchant of Venice, Shylock, all that stuff. But it's curious, isn't it? The first words out of a Jew's mouth are, what profit? What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, and our flesh are very noble of you, Judah. And his brothers listened. Oh, yeah, a bit of money. Well, we can split that, and then, perhaps have a few days down, by the Red Sea. Bit of, bit of diving and swimming. Oh, lovely. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up. Perhaps he thought he was being, rescued after a hard lesson, and lifted him up out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned, obviously a bit later, to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. His half-hearted idea flopped, and he returned to his brother and said, the lad is no more, and where shall I go? How can I explain this? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we found this. Do you know whether it's your son's tunic or not? Not our brother's tunic. Is this your son's, this bloody garment, your son's by any chance? Which is, if you think about it, pretty cruel to an old man. Jacob was somewhere around about 100 years old or thereabouts at this stage, and they're sort of pretty much saying, yeah, I think this is your young boy's tunic, isn't it, Dad? Covered in blood? Really quite cruel, quite heartless. And verse 33, Jacob recognized and said, it's my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and his daughters rose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, for he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And now the Midianites had sold him on in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So poor old Jacob, perhaps 100 years old, is deceived by this tunic. And of course, you could say, maybe some poetic justice here, because if you remember, he deceived his father with a sort of tunic of skins that he'd put on to pretend that he was Esau and steal, you know, Esau's blessings. So, you know, what goes around, I suppose, comes around. But here we are, moving on with Joseph. Joseph, the pampered son, dreams of being somebody super important. And where is he? Sold into slavery in a foreign land. So how's he going to react? Complete change from being the pampered son to being a slave. Will he survive? Will he cave in to despair and despondency? Because all of us can expect challenges, not just somebody like Joseph. Again, keep your place there. Look at Psalms 34. Psalms 34, reading verses 15 to 19. Verse 15, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. Well, of course, if there aren't any righteous, then God's got a fairly quiet life, isn't he? But there are righteous. What we said 2 or 3 weeks ago, there are righteous men and righteous women, and there have been. Jesus referred to many prophets and righteous men. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. The righteous, if there are any, but there are some, the righteous cry out, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart, and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Few are the afflictions of the righteous, if only. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, many. And Joseph was about to experience quite a few. And you have. And I have. You know, if we came together in a room, all of us, and could be honest, we'd probably all between us have quite a high pile of afflictions. Because many are the afflictions of the righteous. But, there is a big but the Lord delivers him out of them all. And if we believe that, then that can give us comfort. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. It's not the fact I'm being afflicted does not mean I'm wicked and an evil. But the scripture tells me that if I'm a righteous person, not perfect, but at least faithful and loyal to God, then the Lord will deliver me out of all my afflictions. So let's go back to Genesis. Pick up the story in Genesis 39. And verses 1 through 6. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. Now, Potiphar, it says captain of the guard, that's sort of like the chief of Pharaoh's police, or perhaps today we'd probably use a phrase like, you know, head of state security. He's the Pharaoh's top man in terms of policing and security. So he's going to be an important man, answering to Pharaoh and in charge of security overall. So quite an important individual. So in a sense, probably not a bad place necessarily to end up as a slave if you're going to end up anywhere as a slave. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he, Potiphar, made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of Jehovah was in all that he had in the house and even in the fields, the agriculture. So he, Potiphar, left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So, you know, Joseph didn't ask to be a slave. Obviously, it wasn't his goal in life. But quite clearly, when he was one, he must have maintained a pretty good attitude, because he's soon recognized by Potiphar as an outstanding individual. And God's blessing Joseph with favor, and God's even blessing Potiphar and his house and his fields. So Joseph, as a young man still, probably, you know, just early 20s, is now overseer over the household of the Egyptian head of security. Right? Now, I'm going to assume that Joseph is still trusting that God will work things out. He's being patient. He knows that. Although, of course, the years are starting to tick along a little bit. And what Joseph is doing, being an honorable, hard-working, dependable, reliable, and, to Potiphar, faithful and loyal servant, is exactly what the Bible expects, in a sense, any of us to do. If you hold your place there, but look at Ephesians 6 and verses 5 through 8. Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 5 through 8. Here's Paul giving instructions, guidance to the brethren in Ephesus, and he says, servants, we've been talking to, you know, parents and children and so on. He says, servants, which of course is what Joseph was back then in Egypt. Servants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart, as to Christ, not with eye service, as men pleases. When somebody's looking at you, you're appearing industrious, but when their back is turned, you're goofing off. Not with eye service, as men pleases, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. So, to servants, be good servants. Be hardworking. Be dependable. Be reliable. Don't have to have somebody watching you. Be a good, honest servant. And that's biblical. That's what church members should be like. It says servants, but you could put employees in there. Employees, be hardworking, be industrious, be a good employee, have a good testimony as an employee or a servant. And Joseph, you know, quite clearly was, and that's pleasing to God. Over those thousands of years later, Paul could still use that as a good example. Let's turn back to Genesis 39. Pick up the next episode in Joseph's life, verses 7 through 20. I just mentioned to the back end of verse 6 that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So, pretty good-looking young man, probably now in his early 20s. The Bible only mentions three men who are particularly good-looking. David and his son Absalom, and Joseph as a third, so I'm going to guess he was outstandingly good-looking young man. Now, it came to pass after these things, and that's probably the reason why it's commented there, came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, this handsome and good-looking young man, and she said, lie with me. Fairly forward. So this is, I guess, what you class as seduction or something similar. But he refused. Of course, later on, some generations later, we know that David had a much poorer response to Bathsheba's appearing in the distance. You know, David yielded to temptation, but Joseph, far better example here, he refused, verse 8, and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. He has committed all he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So, even as a young man, Joseph had, well, strong character, clear understanding of God's commandments and laws. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You know, adultery, it was a sin. Here in chapter 39 of Genesis, long before we got to Exodus 20 and Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments. This is sin and its great wickedness, and it's sin against God. Joseph knew that centuries before Exodus 20. So it was, verse 10, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, relentless, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Now it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside. Why were none of the men of the house inside? One has to assume that the lady was being mischievous and manipulating, and probably made sure there were no men around at this stage. And in comes Joseph, not realizing there's a woman waiting with her tentacles. And then she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he did what you got to do, you know, flee fornication. He left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he, my husband, has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice, being the honorable female I am. And it happened, when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Of course, we all know the saying, hell hath no fury. Like a woman scorned, and she'd been scorned. You know, she probably thinks she's the bee's knees. Oh, you know, so ideal woman, and how can this young Hebrew turn me aside, you know? So she's going to take her vengeance. Then she spoke to him the words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened, as I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside." Which, of course, is all complete fabrication. Lies. "So it was, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, 'Your servant did to me after this manner,' that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him to death." Well, that probably ought to have been the outcome. You know, attempted rape, certainly in those days, would be, I think, the death penalty, particularly attempted rape of the wife of one of Pharaoh's, you know, chief officers. But I think, reading the lines, that Potiphar smelt a rat here. Perhaps a highly perfumed rat. But rather than death penalty, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in the prison. So here's Joseph, does the decent thing, right? Resists temptation. And yet what happens? He's trying to do what's right in God's eyes and honorable and be faithful to his master, Potiphar. And he ends up in prison, falsely accused. You know, so much of trying to live right, if that's what you get for trying to live right, from now on I'm going to live wrong. Well, some people have that concept, don't they? That's just not right, it's not fair. I try to obey God, and look how I've suffered. You know, some people that you and I might know, you might be one of them, have lost jobs over, you know, the church or family or friends because we wanted to keep the Sabbath or holy days or something similar. And obviously, if you're expecting super blessings and things go a bit dark for a while, well, do you get bitter, resentful, stop looking to God? What's the point? That certainly is a temptation, which some people do, of course, give into. But let's look at 1 Peter 2. Keep your place there again. Don't lose your place. 1 Peter 2, verses 18 to 23. Of course, Joseph didn't have the chance to read 1 Peter, but obviously I think he understood quite a lot for a very young man. 1 Peter 2, verses servants, again, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. That probably doesn't go down too well in modern society, particularly if you're a union official. What, telling my employees to be submissive to harsh employers? What are you on about? But, you know, God's values are somewhat different. For this is commendable if, because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. Of course, for Joseph, that's precisely what happened. He's trying to honor God, God's commandments. He's trying to honor Potiphar. He's actually trying to honor Potiphar's wife as well, not giving in to her foolishness. And he suffers wrongfully. And that's commendable. The other isn't. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently for your faults? But when you do good and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And Joseph was an example of that. And perhaps you've suffered as well for doing good. Or maybe you will yet suffer for doing good. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us. Jesus only did good, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, as he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, as, of course, you know, Joseph seemingly did. So let's go back to Genesis 39. Pick up the story in verses 21 through 23. So now Joseph is tossed into prison. It appears to be a prison largely for political prisoners. It's the Pharaoh's prison, not just, I think, the general jail into which the druggies and riffraff went. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. I guess death penalty not appearing, because perhaps some wisdom given to Potiphar to see through his wife's story. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. So, you know, it's quite outstanding in a sense, but quite clearly Joseph has remained positive. He's still a successful man. He's still making a big impact. If you like, you could say he has a great testimony with outsiders. Potiphar thought he was fantastic. The head of the prison thinks he's great. So even though Joseph's through no fault of his own in a pretty, you know, dark place, he's still a great example. How about us? You know, are we perhaps always murmuring and complaining and griping and a bad testimony as a Christian, even though most of the time we're in a reasonably good place? Oh, I think Joseph is a good example here. Look at chapter 40, verses 1 through 8. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker, so he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, Potiphar, in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them, so they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with his own interpretation. Joseph came in to them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said to him, "We each have dreamed a dream, but there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." So Joseph says, "Hey guys, why are you so sad?" You might have thought, well, because we're in prison. But you have to assume somehow that Joseph had created a reasonable atmosphere there so that these guys looked sad, which was uncommon for prisoners in Joseph's prison. Of course, then they tell them their dreams, and Joseph explains and interprets their dreams. One of you will be released, and one of you won't. Let's read verses 14 and 15. This is the chief butler who's going to be released in 3 days' time. And he says, "Remember me when it is well with you. Please show kindness to me. Make mention of me, please, to Pharaoh. Get me out of this dungeon. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. And also I've done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon. I'm a nice guy. I've only done good things. It's just not fair. So when you're released in 3 days, you know, ask the Pharaoh to have me released." Verse 23, "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Well, that's quite a blow, isn't it, really? Yeah, Joseph must have thought, this is it. And then the door opens, perhaps 4 days later, this is it, they're going to come and take me out. Oh, but somebody else coming in. And then, oh, perhaps a day later. And then after a week, Joseph's thinking, it's not going to happen, is it? For some reason, I've been forgotten. So here he is, he's innocent, he's reliable, he's correctly explained dreams to these guys, yet it's just so unfair. He's still in the dungeon. And he could have got morbid and depressed. Good idea, most of us might be in that sort of category. But of course, in a sense, you could see this as Joseph is actually probably learning quite a lot in these years. He's learning the Egyptian language, which he wouldn't have known before, culture, you know, he's in the political prisoners area, he's learning customs. It's all, in a sense, we find out eventually, years of very good preparation. So anyway, 2 more years pass. And knowing Joseph's character so far, I think we can just be assured he's going to keep on being patient and working hard and being noble and being a really genuine good guy, even though it's all totally unfair and he should really be depressed. But we know it sometimes seems darkest, doesn't it, just before the dawn. Let's pick up in 41, seven verses. "It came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. Behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly, there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then, behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly, gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows." Most unusual. You know, cows aren't normally carnivorous. "So Pharaoh awoke." Wow, what was that all about? "Then he slept and dreamt a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on 1 stalk, plump and good. And then behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them, and the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed, it was a dream." Now, he wants to find out what does that mean. And he asks his experts, the magicians, astrologers, nobody can tell. And at this point, the chief butler thinks, oh, I've just remembered. Oh, Pharaoh, there's a guy in prison who interpreted my dream a couple of years ago and the chief baker's dream, and he was spot on. Why don't you get him? So verses 14 through 16. "So Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon." Obviously, we'd probably be a bit smelly and wearing perhaps, prison clothes. So it's a question of he shaved, changed his clothing, came to Pharaoh, nice and smart looking. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've dreamed a dream and nobody can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it." So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, "Well, it's not in me, personally. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." So even here, George is now 30 years old. He still sees God as his guide. And God will give the answer. So, quite clearly, to me at least, Joseph remains utterly loyal, utterly faithful, no matter what he's been through. So let's read verses 25 through 46. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are actually one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after them, are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is a thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will deplete the land, so the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe." And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So that's the interpretation of the dream. And you might think, perhaps Joseph would stop there, but we've seen already, you know, Potiphar recognized that Joseph was a man who was successful, showed initiative, reliable. The guard in the prison saw the same. This man is outstanding. He can put everything under him. He's just got a really good mind, and that becomes evident because, having interpreted the dream, Joseph doesn't stop. He says, "Now therefore," verse 33, "let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man, set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5, you know, 20%, of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. Let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine." So here's a solution. So Joseph, a man of initiative, great ideas, and he says, "Pharaoh, you need to do this. This is going to be the way to deal with this problem. Now that God's given you the insight and the prophecy, here's the way to handle it." So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Well, hang on. Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is clearly the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Now this is the Egyptian Empire. This is a big empire for that day. And Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand, put it on Joseph's hand. He clothed him with garments of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before Joseph, "Bow the knee." So people had to bow or genuflect as Joseph goes by. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh without your consent. No man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So that's quite something, isn't it? Because in one day, Joseph goes from the pit to the palace. He's appointed essentially as prime minister, second only to the Pharaoh. He marries into, you know, aristocracy, nobility, and he's given charge of running the world's greatest empire, ultimately saving millions of lives. He's only 30 years old. That's quite a change, isn't it? you be faithful to God, and this change comes, well, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye almost. You know, he was 17 when he went down to Egypt. He's now 30. So 13 years of delay, of which probably a fair amount of that was in Potiphar's house, at least 2 or 3 years in prison, not sure exactly how long. So, of course, the famine is in the land. Let's pick up the story in 42, verses 1 to 4. So the 7 good years have come and gone, but now the famine is biting. So in chapter 42, verses 1 through 4, when Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt, Jacob over in the land of Canaan says to his sons, "Why do you look at one another? We can't magic up food." He said, "Indeed, I've heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die." So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "Lest some calamity befall him." You know, still smarting from losing Joseph, as he thought, to a wild beast, you know, some 20 or so years earlier. So the brothers go down to Egypt to buy grain. You know, Joseph, it turns out, is in charge of meeting people, distributing the grain. Of course, he recognizes, oh, it's my brothers. Wow. Now, they don't recognize him because he's probably changed a lot from being, you know, 17. Now he's, you know, late 30s and probably bigger and stronger and wearing, you know, sort of fancy Egyptian garb. Maybe he's bearded or not. Who knows? But he accuses them of being spies, come to spy out the land. And, of course, they say, well, we're not spies. He says, oh, yes, you are. And they tell him about their dad back in Canaan and their other brother. And so Joseph says, well, okay, to prove that you are being honest, bring that brother down here into Egypt. And you go back and fetch him, and I'll keep Simeon here in custody, you know, to make sure you come back. So they go back home. They're not very happy. Jacob is distraught because they tell him, if we go back, we've got to bring Benjamin. What are you telling about Benjamin? We didn't know he was going to ask all this stuff. So Jacob says, no, you're not going back to Egypt. You're not taking young Benjamin. I'm not prepared to lose my youngest favorite son now. But of course, eventually the food runs out and they've got no option but to go back to Egypt with Benjamin. Jacob, no doubt, fearing the worst. And they get down there and meet Joseph again. Joseph continues to conceal, you know, who he is. He makes a big feast, great big meal for all the brothers, and they all line up exactly in order of age, which stuns them. Young Benjamin, who of course is Joseph's actual brother, they had the same mother, gets a bumper helping of food, and then, you know, they're sent back home with sacks full of grain only. Joseph has arranged to put his special cup in Benjamin's sack, and eventually they're held up by Joseph's, you know, stewards. Examination takes place. You've stolen my master's special cup. So they all go back to Egypt, back to Joseph, and Joseph says, look, guys, you shouldn't have done that. You should have known better, but I'll keep the one in whose sack the special cup was found as my slave. The rest of you, take your grain and go back to your father. Oops! Let's pick up the story in Genesis 44, verses 15 through 34. Genesis 44, verse 15. Joseph said to them, what deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination? Didn't you think I'd notice that you'd stolen? Bit of a game this, of course. Then Judah said, you know, Judah's the man that wanted to sell the young Joseph. What shall we say to our Lord? My Lord, what shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants here. Oh, here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found, you know, Benjamin. But Joseph said, far be it from me that I should do so. But the man in whose hand the cup was found, he only shall be my slave. As for you, go up in peace to your father. Then Judah came near to him and said, oh, my lord, please let your servant speak a word in my lord's hearing. Do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servants, you know, last time, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, well, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. And we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more. So it was, when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. For we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my grey hair with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen. When he sees that the lad's not with us, he will die. And so your servants will bring down the grey hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant, you know, Judah, became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please let your servant, that's me, Judah, remain in Egypt, instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? So I suspect Joseph is running a test here. You know, these guys abandoned him when he was a young boy. Are they going to abandon Benjamin now to remain behind in Egypt? Just look after themselves, not care about the impact on their father? And the answer is, well, at least Judah has improved. He says, look, my lord, I can't. It'll destroy my father if he loses his younger son. Keep me, Judah, as your slave. So Judah is willing to sacrifice himself to protect his father and to protect young Benjamin. And that's really a pretty important change almost in Judah. Let's pick up in 45, verses 1 through 15. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He can't kick it up any longer. He's got to just, well, I've got to let these guys know who I am. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Thinking, oh, we're in serious trouble now if that is Joseph. Joseph said to his brothers, please come near me. And they came near, I'm sure somewhat slowly. And he said, I'm Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither ploughing nor harvesting. Still early on in the famine. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Hasten, go up to my father. Say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen. You shall be near me, you, your children, your children's children, your flocks, your herds, all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. Of course, he's speaking Hebrew now. Up till then, he was using an interpreter. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that you have seen. and you shall hasten and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. You know, his older brother. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. So it's an outstanding story. Eventually, the brothers, everybody else does bow down to Joseph as the dreams told him. So here's Joseph now in his late 30s, I guess. He lives to be 110 years old. So he has many, many decades of prosperity and peace with his family around him and his father. His God-given dreams, which they were, have come true. And, you know, God clearly watched over Joseph, used him powerfully for the benefit of the house of Israel and even the world, in a sense. And it's quite encouraging to see somebody like Joseph in the scriptures, a man who came through some difficult tests, some trials, some really serious disappointments, who could easily have given up to depression and despair at any time. But Joseph was faithful and loyal to everybody, right? To God and to man. He's a great example, really, for us. So let's look finally, final scripture, 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9, which we read last week, but it makes sense again here. 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9. God has sent a prophet, or at least a seer, to King Asa with a message. This is not just, you know, Hanani's opinions. He's actually presenting a message from God. Verse 9, "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him." God understands that we have flaws, we make mistakes. Our knowledge is at times, you know, not perfect. But if our hearts are loyal to God, then this scripture, quoted by Hanani the seer, says that God's eyes are out there, roving around, looking for people who are loyal to him, so he can show himself strong in their lives. And of course, Joseph, great example of that. So we may not possess all the technical knowledge. We might stumble far too often. But I think all of us can try and do what Joseph did and endeavor to be faithful and loyal to our God, irrespective of the circumstances and situation. And with that, we'll conclude today's Bible study.